From the outrage of Jallianwala Bagh massacre, Gandhi had forged a nationwide uprising against the British, the non-cooperation movement. The movement had gained tremendous pan-India momentum before Gandhi called it off, after a mob set fire to a police station in Chauri Chaura in which 22 policemen died. Gandhi was sentenced to 6 years in jail, but released in February 1924 due to his failing health. On his release, Gandhi began a new movement, the Charkha, a protest against British might rooted in self-reliance. Gandhi's stature was sky-high, as were the nationalist passions, when Rabindranath Tagore, the most celebrated poet of his time, wrote a scathing piece in Modern Review, a Calcutta-based magazine of great repute. The article was titled The Cult of the Charkha. The article criticized not just the non-cooperation movement, the Charkha, but the ideas of patriotism, nationalism, which Gandhi stood for. As is livelihood for the individual, so is politics for a particular people, a field for the exercise of their business instincts of patriotism. All this time, just as business has implied antagonism, so has politics been concerned with the self-interest of a pugnacious nationalism, Tagore wrote in the September 1925 edition of Modern Review. Tagore's criticism and Gandhi's reception of the article, which we carry below, along with several other exchanges, show not just the intellectual depth of the two giant thinkers of modern India. These exchanges also show the motions that ideas like patriotism, nationalism, and Swaraj went through, the respectful but irreverent conversations in which they were born before becoming the founding principles of an independent and modern India. Extracts of a piece written by Tagore in response to Gandhi's call for non-cooperation, published in Modern Review in May 1921.
What is Swaraj? It is Maya. It is like a mist that will vanish, leaving no stain on the radiance of the eternal. However we may delude ourselves with the phrases learned from the West, Swaraj is not our objective. Our fight is a spiritual fight. It is for man. We are to emancipate man from the meshes that he himself has woven around him, these organizations of national egoism. The butterfly will have to be persuaded that the freedom of the sky is of higher value than the shelter of the cocoon. If we can defy the strong, the armed, the wealthy, revealing to the world power of the immortal spirit, the whole castle of the giant flesh will vanish in the void. And then man will find his Swaraj. We, the famished, ragged ragamuffins of the East, are to win freedom for all humanity. We have no word for nation in our language. When we borrow this word from other people, it never fits us. For we are to make our league with Narayan, and our victory will not give us anything but victory itself. Victory for God's world. I have seen the West. I covet not the unholy feast in which she revels every moment, growing more and more bloated and red and dangerously delirious. Not for us is this mad orgy of midnight with lighted torches, but awakenment in the serene light of morning.
Gandhi's response to Tagore's criticism of non-cooperation, published as an article in Young India on June 1, 1921, titled The Poet's Anxiety. In it, Gandhi discusses his idea of non-violent non-cooperation.
I therefore think that the poet has been unnecessarily alarmed at the negative aspect of non-cooperation. We had lost the power of saying no. It had become disloyal, almost sacrilegious to say no to the government. This deliberate refusal to cooperate is like the necessary weeding process that a cultivator has to resort to before he sows. Weeding is as necessary to agriculture as sowing. Indeed, even whilst the crops are growing, the weeding fork, as every husbandman knows, is an instrument almost of daily use. The nation's non-cooperation is an invitation to the government to cooperate with it on its own terms, as is every nation's right and every good government's duty, Non-cooperation is the nation's notice that it is no longer satisfied to be in tutelage. The nation had taken to the harmless, natural and religious doctrine of non-cooperation in the place of the unnatural and irreligious doctrine of violence. And if India is ever to attain the Swaraj of the poet's dream, she will do so only by non-violent non-cooperation. Let him deliver his message of peace to the world and feel confident that India, through her non-cooperation, if she remains true to her pledge, will have exemplified his message. Non-cooperation is intended to give the very meaning to patriotism that the poet is yearning to offer. And India, prostrate at the feet of Europe, can give no hope to humanity. And India, awakened and free, has a message of peace and goodwill to a groaning world. Non-cooperation is designed to supply her with a platform from which she will preach the message.
Tagore continues the argument with another rejoinder to Gandhi's ideas in a piece titled The Call of Truth, published in Bengali in Pravasi first and later in Modern Review. He wrote this piece in the backdrop of World War I, which had just ended, killed millions of people and shattered many countries. He urged nationalists to rise from self-interest, reconsider non-cooperation and instead work for welfare of the world.
The time, moreover, has arrived when we must think of one thing more, and that is this. The awakening of India is a part of the awakening of the world. The door of the new age has been flung open at the trumpet blast of a great war. We have read in the Mahabharata how the day of self-revelation had to be preceded by a year of retirement. The same has happened in the world today. Nations had attained nearness to each other without being aware of it. That is to say, the outside fact was there, but it had not penetrated into the mind. At the shock of the war, the truth of it stood revealed to mankind. The foundation of modern, that is, Western civilization was shaken, and it has become evident that the convulsion is neither local nor temporary, but has traversed the whole earth and will last until the shocks between man and man, which have extended from continent to continent, can be brought to rest and a harmony be established. From now onward, any nation which takes an isolated view of its own country will run counter to the spirit of the new age and know no peace. From now onward, the anxiety that each country has for its own safety must embrace the welfare of the world. For some time, the working of the new spirit has occasionally shown itself even in the government of India, which has had to make attempts to deal with its own problems in the light of the world problem. The war has torn away a veil from before our minds. What is harmful to the world is harmful to each of us. This was a maxim that we used to read in books. Now mankind has seen it at work and has understood that wherever there is injustice, even if the external right of possession is there, the true right is wanting. So that it is worthwhile even to sacrifice some outward right in order to gain the reality. This immense change which is coming over the spirit of man, raising it from the petty to the great, is already at work even in Indian politics. There will doubtless be imperfections and obstacles without number. Self-interest is sure to attack enlightened interest at every step. Nevertheless, it would be wrong to come to the decision that the working of self-interest alone is honest and the larger-hearted striving is hypocritical. In this morning of the world's awakening, if in only our own national striving there is no response to its universal aspiration, that will betoken the poverty of our spirit.
Mahatma Gandhi wrote this piece titled The Great Sentinel, published on October 13, 1921 in Young India as a response to Call of Truth. Gandhi defends Charkha and non-cooperation and defends the idea of Swaraj or self-rule. Responding to Tagore's idea of an international solidarity, Gandhi says, "A drowning man cannot save others."
Hunger is the argument that is driving India to the spinning wheel. The call for the spinning wheel is the noblest of all, because it is the call of love, and love is Swaraj. The spinning wheel will curb the mind when the time is spent on necessary physical labor and can be set to do so. Our non-cooperation is with the system the English have established, with the material civilization and its attendant greed and exploitation of the weak. Our non-cooperation is a retirement within ourselves. Our non-cooperation is a refusal to cooperate with the English administrators on their own terms. We say to them, come and cooperate with us on our terms. And it will be well for us, for you, and the world. We must refuse to be lifted off our feet. A drowning man cannot save others. In order to be fit to save others, we must try to save ourselves. Indian nationalism is not exclusive, nor aggressive, nor destructive. It is health-giving, religious, and therefore humanitarian. India must learn to live before she can aspire to die for humanity. The mice which helplessly find themselves between the cat's teeth acquire no merit from their enforced sacrifice.
In the next piece called The Cult of the Charkha, published in Modern Review in September 1925, Tagore excoriates Gandhi's idea of patriotism, Charkha, and calls the prevalent nationalist politics of the time a pugnacious nationalism.
Swaraj cannot be based on any external conformity, but only on the internal union of hearts. If a great union is to be achieved, its field must be great likewise. But if out of the whole field of economic endeavor only one fractional portion be selected for special concentration thereon, then we may get homespun thread and even genuine khaddar, but we shall not have united in the pursuit of one great complete purpose, the lives of our countrymen. As is livelihood for the individual, so is politics for a particular people, a field for the exercise of their business instincts of patriotism. All this time, just as business has implied antagonism, so has politics been concerned with the self-interest of a pugnacious nationalism. The forging of arms and of false documents has been its main activity. The burden of competitive armaments has been increasing apace, with no end to it in sight. No peace for the world in prospect.
Responding to this unusually piercing attack on his politics, Gandhi writes a long piece titled The Poet and the Charkha. The piece is placatory and, while being deferent to Tagore, bristles at the supposed ignorance of the idea that Tagore has mockingly called the cult of the Charkha. This extract ends in what is undoubtedly an equally sharp remark. It was published in Young India on November 5, 1925.
The poet lives in a magnificent world of his own creation, his world of ideas. I am a slave of somebody else's creation, the spinning wheel. The poet makes his gopis dance to the tune of his flute. I wander after my beloved Sita, the Charkha, and seek to deliver her from the ten-headed monster from Japan, Manchester, Paris, etc. The poet is an inventor. He creates, destroys, and recreates. I'm an explorer, and having discovered a thing, I must cling to it. The poet does not, he is not expected, he has no need to read Young India. All he knows about the movement is what he has picked up from table talk. He has therefore denounced what he has imagined to be the excesses of the Charkha cult. He thinks, for instance, that I want everybody to spin the whole of his or her time to the exclusion of all other activity. That is to say that I want the poet to forsake his muse, the farmer his plough, the lawyer his brief, and the doctor his lancet. So far is this form of truth that I've asked no one to abandon his calling, but on the contrary to adorn it by giving every day only 30 minutes to spinning as sacrifice for the whole nation. I have indeed asked the famishing to spin for a living and the half-starved farmer to spin during his leisure hours to supplement his slender resources. If the poet spun half an hour daily, his poetry would gain in richness, for it would then represent the poor man's wants and woes in a more forcible manner than now.
But the exchanges between Gandhi and Tagore weren't only sparks and fire produced by crashing of two flint stones. Mahatma Ji and Gurudev, as the two referred to each other, privately loved and remembered each other in despair, while flaying each other's ideas in public. Describing his relationship with Tagore, Gandhi wrote this piece in Young India on February 25, 1926.
I have not differed from Dr. Tagore in many matters. There are certainly differences of opinion between us in some matters. It would be strange if there were none. Indeed, the friendship between us is all the richer and truer for the intellectual differences between us.
Tagore wrote this heartfelt appeal for help to Gandhi at a time when he was physically worn out and financially exhausted by trying to keep Shantiniketan from sinking. It was written from Shantiniketan on September 12, 1935.
My dear Mahatmaji, I am glad Suren had an opportunity to discuss with you in detail the financial situation of the ashram during his recent visit to Wardha. I know how busy you are with your various activities, and though I have often thought of telling you of my difficulties, I have never done so before. But Charlie insisted that you must be informed about the situation, and then only I gave permission to discuss it with you. Over 30 years I have practically given my all to this mission of my life, and so long as I was comparatively young and active, I faced all my difficulties unaided, and through my struggles the institution grew up in its manifold aspects. And now, however, when I am 75, I feel the burden of my responsibility growing too heavy for me, that owing to some deficiency in me, that my appeals fail to find adequate response in the heart of my people through the cause that I have done my utmost to serve is certainly valuable. Constant begging excursions with absurdly meager results, added to the strain of my daily anxieties, have brought my physical constitution nearly to an extreme verge of exhaustion. Now I know of none else but yourself whose words may help my countrymen to realize that it is worth their while to maintain this institution in fullness of its functions and to relieve me of perpetual worry at this last period of my waning life and health. With deepest love, Rabindranath Tagore.
Gandhi responded with equal concern and affection in this letter on October 13, 1935.
Dear Gurudev, your touching letter was received only on 11th when I was in the midst of meetings. In the hope of delivering it to me personally, Anil needlessly detained it. I hope he is now quite restored to health. Yes, I have the financial position before me now. You may depend upon my straining every nerve to find the required money. I am groping. I am trying to find the way out. It will take some time before I can report the result of my search to you. It is unthinkable that you should have to undertake another begging mission at your age. The necessary funds must come to you without your having to stir out of Shantiniketan. I hope you're keeping well. Padmaja, who was with you a few days ago, is here for the day and has been telling me how you have aged. With reverential love, yours, M.K. Gandhi.
Within 5 months, Gandhi had arranged the funds enough to take the worries away from Tagore and fund the institution that he had raised with so much care and love, and responded to him on March 27, 1936.
Dear Gurudev, God has blessed my poor effort, and here's the money. Now you will relieve the public mind by announcing cancellation of the rest of the program. May God keep you for many a year to come. Yours with love, M.K. Gandhi.